Hi, Dave Emery here. Side 2 of For the Record, program number 805, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on August 10th of the year 2014. We're going to plunge right back in. We have been reading from an article about the standoff at the Cleveland Bundy Ranch. It is from Salon.com of July 22nd of 2014, authored by Paul Rosenberg, headlined, A Much Larger and More Dangerous Movement, Right-Wing Militias Thrive Post-Bundy. And it deals with a report from the Southern Poverty Law Center. Skipping down in the article, the Bundy Ranch standoff wasn't a spontaneous response to Cleveland Bundy's predicament, but rather a well-organized, military-type action that reflects the potential for violence from a much larger and more dangerous movement, unquote, said Mark Potok, senior fellow in the SPLC's Intelligence Project and lead author of the report, in a statement accompanying the report, quote, This incident may have faded from public view, but if our government doesn't pay attention, we will be caught off guard as much as the Bureau of Land Management was on that day. Quote, SPLC's piece is focused on the need for law enforcement to be ready in light of the apparent military-style planning of the Bundy protest. They are arguing that the Bundy Ranch was a trap and that it worked, unquote, said veteran researcher Frederick Clarkson, C-L-A-R-K-S-O-N, author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, co-founder of the group researchers blog Talk to Action, and a senior fellow at Political Research Associates, quote, Indeed, given the involvement of former military and police officers in the Oath Keepers, one of the groups involved in the standoff, that far-right figures would apply their knowledge to such situations is to be expected, unquote. There are two For the Record shows called Specialized Knowledge and Abilities that I think people should reference in this context. And again, what we're looking at here is really to an extent a realization of the Turner Diaries scenario. Continuing, Mark Potok observes that the episode suggests that there is potential for, quote, violence from a much larger and more dangerous movement. It is a good point, and one all sectors of society need to take seriously, Clarkson said. Speaking to Salon, Potok himself made it clear it was the government as a whole, rather than the BLM specifically, that bore the brunt of the blame. Quote, The BLM certainly could have gone in a better way. The optics were obviously terrible. It was not the best approach, Potok said. On the other hand, at the end of the day, they did the right thing. They didn't try to tough it out. As for the BLM itself, I actually feel sorry for them. This is not a law enforcement agency. Mostly, people who work for BLM go to college and study land use issues, unquote. The problem is much more one of interagency coordination, leadership, and simple recognition of the widespread threat of right-wing violence, a failure epitomized by the Obama administration's knee-jerk disavowal of a Department of Homeland Security report on right-wing extremism leaked to right-wing media in April of 2009. As Potok noted, this disavowal came despite two basic facts, that a similar report on the virtually non-existent radical left had been issued 6 months earlier, and second, the fact that the report itself was, quote, a fair, sober, and prescient analysis of what was going on, unquote. In fact, again quoting, virtually everything that was written in that report came to pass in one way or another, unquote. But it was not just the government that was caught flat-footed. The media's sensationalist approach obscured as much or more than it revealed, aided, unquote, as it were by its slavish devotion to, quote, balanced coverage, unquote. And the conservative establishment that first embraced and then fled from Bundy has a long and symbiotic partnership with the farthest fringes of bottomless paranoia it regards as a natural resource without end. Neither the corporate media though the establishment right shows any signs of having learned anything lasting from the Bundy Ranch standoff. Some future sequel spinoff or copycat seems virtually inevitable, above and beyond what we have already seen. The Bundy Ranch standoff may have been unique in one respect, the report admits, in terms of its utter brazenness, unquote. Rarely have even the most militant of members of the anti-government patriot movement been photographed aiming sniper rifles at the heads of law enforcement officials. Almost never has a group of heavily armed right-wing radicals facing large numbers of equally heavily armed law enforcement forced the government to back down. But it belongs on a spectrum of similar confrontations over the decades and was clearly less lethal than many of them, including, of course, the Oklahoma City bombing, which left 168 people dead, including 19 babies and children. Part of what distinguished the Bundy Ranch confrontation, the report suggests, was the role of Ryan Payne, a 30-year-old militiaman from Anaconda, Montana, who had deployed twice to Iraq and who played a key role in recruiting hundreds of other militia members to support Bundy and in positioning the snipers, leading the BLM to withdraw. Payne, that's P-A-Y-N-E, is a member of a small local militia group, the West Mountain Rangers, but he also, quote, sits atop a little-known militia organization called Operation Mutual Aid, a group that he hoped could coordinate militias across the country to respond to federal aggressions, unquote, according to the report. SPLC interviewed Payne weeks after the confrontation. After a Bundy family video of their initial confrontations went viral, Payne jumped into action, first talking with Bundy and then driving through the night with another member of his militia, Jim Lardy, L-A-R-D-Y, quote, a few sleeping bags in tow, burning up cell phones, hoping to bring every militia member they could. On April 9th, he sent out an urgent call for the militias to mobilize, unquote, saying that 150 members had already responded, quote, but that number is growing by the hour, unquote. Once he arrived, he took on the role of a battlefield planner, a role that paid off big time when the BLM decided to retreat rather than precipitate a bloody confrontation. Recounting the days several weeks later from the Bundy compound, Payne smiled. In the days before the standoff, he and Cleveland Bundy had toured the public lands that Bundy was using, looking for ways to defend them if necessary. He knew the battlefield, planned the response by Bundy's supporters, and made sure snipers were in position. In his telling, his planning could not have gone more perfectly. Not only did they take up the very best position to overwatch everything, they also had the high ground. They were fortified with concrete and pavement barriers, unquote, Payne said, again quoting, they had great lines of fire, and then, when I sent in that other team for counter-sniper positions, the BLM agents were completely locked down. They had no choice but to retreat, unquote. The reason, he boasted, was, quote, overwhelming tactical superiority, unquote. But a good case can be made that the real reason was strategic and political, not tactical. Contrary to all the right-wing paranoia, the American government has never seriously focused on the militia movement, its antecedents, and allies in a sustained manner commensurate with the threats that it poses, although it has handled some specific incidents in an exemplary manner. Ironically, in contrast, Potok told Salon that local, on-the-ground law enforcement has been keenly aware of the right-wing militia threat ever since the Oklahoma City bombing, though tellingly, not before it. The fact that Bundy was decades in arrears in the money he owed for grazing his cattle on public lands was just one more piece of evidence of how the government's lax attitude toward conservative lawbreakers breeds a sense of impunity and entitlement, which is also strongly supported by mainstream conservative voices, as well as media figures who straddle the ever-shrinking divide between mainstream conservatism and the lawless, violence-prone fringe. The report not only provides a broad overview of how violence-prone right-wing anti-government conspiracism and broader land use grievances have interacted since the 1970s, It also provides direct evidence of how Bundy himself had espoused such fringe views throughout his decades-long period of refusing to pay the minimal grazing fees he owes. But as far-reaching as it is still remarkably focused, Clarkson points out. The issue in the case of the Bundy grazing fees is a long-standing issue of federal lands in the West, but there are many such rallying points for the Patriot Movement and its prospective allies, informed by a volatile range of beliefs, many of them religious, unquote. While the report does mention religion in passing, as Clarkson suggests, there's a great deal more out there that lies beyond its scope. In 2001, for example, there was an analogous situation when the Indianapolis Baptist Temple, which had refused to withhold taxes from their employee paychecks, faced the seizure of their assets. Militia groups also turned out to defend the church. Clarkson said that, quote, in a post-Hobby Lobby world, who's to say what would happen with similar situations today? In that case, however, law enforcement simply waited until almost everyone had gone home and 3 months later seized the church without violence, unquote, Clarkson noted. Again quoting, not every such standoff need end in violence, but ideological shifts in elements of the Christian right in recent years also point to a growing potential, if not actual preparation, for violence, unquote. With this broader threat in mind, let's refocus on what the war in the West does tell us. Most broadly, it takes up the modern history of the militia movement and its kin with William Potter Gale's creation of the Posse Comitatus. Again, we went into Gale at great length in AFA programs 10, 11, 12, and 13, particularly 11 and 12, and his connections to, on the one hand, the MacArthur group within the military, and also the milieu operating out of Guy Bannister's detective agency. That was one of the major focal points of New Orleans DA Jim Garrison's investigation into the JFK assassination. Back to what the war in the West goes into. Historic resistance to federal authority grew far sharper and more ideologically refined with the emergence of the radical right in the 1970s and the 1980s, in particular the racist and anti-Semitic Posse Comitatus. The Posse, whose name is Latin for power of the county, pushed an especially radical localism originating in the doctrine of county supremacy, unquote, even as it married elements of the tax protest movement to Christian identity, a heretical reading of the Bible that depicts Jews as biologically satanic and people of color as subhuman. In common law, posse comitatus means the authority of a law officer to conscript any able-bodied males to assist him, unquote. In American history, it refers to the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, a federal law prohibiting the military from policing non-federal property, which was intended specifically to cripple enforcement of the Civil War amendments, which granted full citizenship and legal protections to former slaves and their descendants. At its core, Gale's Posse Comitatus seeks to elevate a mere statute to the level of a core constitutional principle, and not just any law, but a law passed specifically for the purpose of effectively nullifying three separate constitutional amendments and reducing African Americans back to the de facto level of slaves. I'm going to pause here. Again, note the origins of this in the basically the anti-Reconstruction period of the Deep South, and the specific focusing of this activity on neutralizing the civil liberties of African Americans. I would note again that just exactly this sort of anti-government doctrine masquerading as, quote, libertarianism, unquote, is at the very core of the Snowdenistas, Edward Snowden himself and the elements around him. And we have noted in past discussion of the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, of the profound connections between the Palestinian Libertarian Organization, the Ludwig von Mises Institute, people like David Duke, the Neo-Confederate Movement and the League of the South, and people who quite literally believe in slavery. This article goes on to talk about how the media basically coddled Bundy and as did the GOP, skipping down in this article. Virtually all of the far-right's conspiracist beliefs are transparent lies if you can trace them back far enough. But that assumes a truth-seeking function on somebody's part, an assumption that is clearly unwarranted. In our age of savagely decimated newsrooms, fact-free he said, she said journalism appears to be the only kind that most organizations can manage, a style that naturally gives the advantage to those like Bundy who just make things up, carefully tailored to bolster their arguments. The vast majority of reporters have little or no background in covering movements, Potok told Salon. This is not a criticism of individual reports, but a reflection on, quote, what has happened over 20 years of the collapse of the news media and the rise of opinion journalism, unquote. With the collapse of newspapers, there are, quote, very few people who are truly knowledgeable about the far right, he said. And skipping down. This was hardly an isolated example, Potok noted. The right wing of the Republican Party has done a hell of a lot to help move completely fringe conspiracy theories and propaganda from far right, from the far right of our society into the political mainstream. I would also add, although it's not talked about here, elements of the so-called progressive sector have done something very similar. I'm thinking offhand of how so-called progressives, some of them anyway, flocked for the, quote, truther movement, unquote, maintaining that a controlled demolition was involved in the bringing down of the World Trade Center towers, something that is not only demonstrably false, but physically impossible. And frankly, coming from someone with many years' experience in various features, various aspects of the building trades, it is absolutely insane. Not just wrong, not just physically impossible, it is completely and utterly whacked. But the truthers are absolutely convinced of it, and they constitute, I think, something of an element that is quite like this. We're going to move on. By the way, there is much more to that article. The entire article is in the description for the record, 805. Again, I turn every program into a long article-length written description. Often, as will be the case in today, there is information in the description that I did not have time to fit into the hour long program. We're going to move from a clandestine, ostensibly illegal military formation in the U.S., although actually it has received a lot of support from the milieu of the Republican Party, to a clandestine military organization in post-World War II Germany. Although there are some differences here, I would note again that although this is supposed to be a secret army that somehow spontaneously grew up, in fact, it appears to have been sanctioned not only by NATO, but by elements of the German government and the Konrad Adenauer administration in the early 1950s. It appears to have been part of a NATO intelligence operation called Operation Stay Behind, which used ultra-right wingers and doctrinaire fascists from World War II as anti-communist cadre in case of either an invasion of Western Europe by Soviet forces or by a spontaneous takeover of the political apparatus by communists or leftists. Now, this is a very good article from Der Spiegel of May 14th of 2014. It's by Klaus Wiegreffe, W-I-E-G-R-E-F-E. It's called Nazi Veterans Created Illegal Army. And in this article, again, we're going to take a look at Waffen-SS veterans and Wehrmacht veterans in what was basically a clandestine army, but it was not actually illegal. It was supported by the Adenauer government, by the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit, by NATO, by the U.S. And one of the most telling aspects of this story concerns the fact that at one point the BND, in the discussion of what was to be done with this outfit, recommended that, quote, the SS should be consulted in connection with this. It specifically referred to the SS, and again, this is in the 1950s, as in the present tense and as a continually functioning organization. And again, the SS was to be consulted. Again, Der Spiegel of May 14th of 2014, an article by Klaus Wiegreffer, W-I-E-G-R-E-F-E, Nazi veterans created illegal army. And it reads in part, skipping down, the previously secret documents revealed the existence of a coalition of approximately 2,000 former officers, veterans of the Nazi-era Wehrmacht and the Waffen-SS, who decided to put together an army in post-war Germany in 1949. They made their preparations without a mandate from the German government, without the knowledge of the parliament, and the documents show, by circumventing Allied occupation forces. Skipping down, historian Agilolf, A-G-I-L-O-L-F, Kesselring, found the documents which belong to the Galen organization, the predecessor to the current Foreign Intelligence Agency, while working for an independent historical commission hired by the BND to investigate its early history. Similar commissions have been hired by a number of German authorities in recent years, including the finance and foreign ministries, to create an accurate record of once hushed-up legacies. Skipping down again. According to the papers, German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer didn't find out about the existence of the paramilitary group until 1951, at which point he evidently did not decide to break it up. Skipping down again. Among the group's most important actors was Albert Schnez, S-C-H-N-E-Z, as in zebra. Schnez was born in 1911 and served as a colonel in World War II before ascending the ranks of the Bundeswehr, which was founded in 1955. By the end of the 1950s, he was part of the entourage of Defense Minister Franz Josef Strauß of the CDU, and later served the German army under Chancellor Willy Brandt and Defense Minister Helmut Schmidt, both of the SPD. Statements by Schnez quoted in the document suggest that the project to build a clandestine army was also supported by Hans Speidel, capital S-P-E-I-D-E-L, who would become the NATO Supreme Commander of the Allied Army in Central Europe in 1957, and Adolf Heusinger, the first Inspector General of the Bundeswehr. I would add, Adolf Heusinger was basically in charge of the German army in World War II. Skipping down. Contemporaries describe Schnez as an energetic organizer, but also self-confident and aloof. He maintained contacts with the League of German Youth and its specialized organization, the Technical Services, which were preparing themselves for a partisan war against the Soviets. The two groups, secretly funded by the United States, included former Nazi officers as members, and were both banned by the West German federal government in 1953 as extreme right organizations. Schnez, it seems, had no qualms whatsoever associating himself with former Nazis. Again, skipping down. U.S. documents viewed by Spiegel indicate that Schnez negotiated with former SS Obersturmbannführer Otto Skorzeny. The SS officer became a Nazi hero during World War II after he carried out a successful mission to free deposed Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, who had been arrested by the Italian king. The former SS man had pursued plans similar to those of Schnez. In February of 1951, the two agreed to cooperate immediately in the Swabia region, unquote. It is still unknown today what precisely became of that deal. Skipping down again. A notation in papers from the Galen organization states that there had, quote, long been relations of a friendly nature, unquote, between Schnez and General Reinhard Galen. And skipping down again. Still, Adenauer decided not to take action against Schnez's organization, which raises several questions. Was he shying away from a conflict with veterans of the Wehrmacht and the Waffen-SS, and skipping down still again? With regard to this organization, the Galen organization man suggested, quote, consulting the SS, unquote, adding that the, quote, SS is a factor, and we should sound out opinions in detail there before making a decision, unquote. Apparently, networks of old and former Nazis still exercise considerable influence during the 1950s. Again, this is one of the most important things. This is in the 1950s. And the BND officer suggests, quote, consulting the SS, unquote, adding that, quote, the SS is a factor and we should sound out opinions in detail there before making a decision. And the article goes on to say, apparently, networks of old and former Nazis still exercise considerable influence during the 1950s. I refer interested listeners to the book The New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Tettens from 1961. Again, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. We are almost out of time, and there is a lot of information in this program, in the description for the program, that we will not have time to get into the broadcast itself. One of them concerns the alleged suicide of former Florida Secretary of State Catherine Harris's husband. He was a Swede named Anders Ebbesen, E-B-B-E-S-O-N. USA Today of November 19th of 2013 had an article, police, Catherine Harris's husband commits suicide, unquote. Then another article from the Tampa Bay Times of October 20th of 2006, Catherine Harris's most steadfast supporter, unquote, by Anita Kumar, K-U-M-A-R. It talks about Anders Ebbesen's background. He worked for Electrolux. That was a company founded by a Nazi supporter and probable Nazi spy, Axel Werner Grimm, and then mentions that he founded his own company that manufactured appliances for luxury yachts. Given that Catherine Harris occupied a political milieu in Florida, both closely connected with the Borman Flight Capital Network and with drug smuggling and the 9/11 attacks, one wonders if perhaps ongoing investigations may have led to the, quote, suicide of Anders Ebbesen. And there is numerous supplemental material in this description talking about the links between the milieu of Axel Werner Grimm and the Borman Flight Capital Network. The last story we're going to talk about, and again, I can only briefly highlight it, from Army Times of July 31st of 2014, an article by Jim Tice, T-I-C-E, German officer to serve as U.S. Army Europe's chief of staff, skipping down. Brigadier General Marcus Lubenthal, most recently the commander of Germany's 12th Panzer Brigade in Hamburg and chief of staff of Regional Command North, International Security Assistance Force Afghanistan, will be stationed at USAREUR headquarters in Wiesbaden, Germany. He is going to be the chief of staff for U.S. Army Europe. I wonder why they couldn't appoint an American general instead. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record, program number 805. Miscellaneous articles and updates do go to the description on the SpitfireList.com website for a more complete delineation of some of the points of information I only had time to touch on at the end. This has been recorded on August 10th of 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.